They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh. So when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two one mine?
Hello and welcome to Basque Cat Podcast, episode 17, the 17 steps. We have Amy, Maria, Turk, Curly, Marie, Taylor, and me. There's a lot of us today. And the first thing we're going to do is, well, the first thing I'm going to do, is talk about this new episode as an update of the canon story. And I'm going to make this very quick because I don't really want to bore you with the plot of Hound of the Baskervilles. So what I have for you is some differences and some similarities. So the first similarity between these two stories is that they're both very much John Watson stories. The canon story, because for most of it, Watson is actually alone walking around the moor and spending time in Baskerville Hall and interrogating everyone, and the episode for other reasons. But they both have these elements in common that they're away from London, that you're in a setting where you have to deal with a lot of people and you have to do a lot of talking, and they are both set in an environment in which John Watson functions much better than Sherlock, or Sherlock Holmes, rather. Obviously, with the whole army base, with the connection, and that John can do things there that Sherlock can't. We have that link with Baskerville. And the second similarity is that we have the idea of superstition or irrationality versus rationality. In the canon story, we have the legend, the family legend of the Baskervilles, the legend of the monstrous hound that roams the moor and kills everyone who has the last name Baskerville. In the episode, obviously, we have Henry Knight and his weird visions when nobody knows whether he's imagined it or if it's actually a real thing. And we have Watson as Holmes's stand-in in the canon story and having to be the voice of reason. And in the episode, we actually go so far as to see him being the voice of reason for Sherlock and at Sherlock. So that's the similarities. I have two differences as well. And the first difference is that Hound of the Baskervilles, well, I think personally, isn't really a horror story. The main plot of it, maybe, but there are other elements in there as well. There's lots of mystery, there's a puzzle with lots of red herrings, there's a love story or a love intrigue going on as well. So when you see adaptations of the story, usually they edit the story to fit what they want to focus on, and Margatis decided to focus on the horror bit, so that's what we're getting, but that's, I think, not really what it is, because it is a mix of things. It is a lot of things in the canon. And the second big difference is that, well, Sherlock Holmes is actually there, whereas in the canon story, he's not. In the canon story, he sends Watson off to Dartmoor saying, yeah, you go and investigate, I stay here in London because I'm too busy. And the later it is revealed that he's not actually been spending his time in London at all. He's been hiding out on the moor the whole time, which I think is a really, really jerky move of Holmes. So because we have this as the difference, and Sherlock is actually there, we don't get the scene that you get in every adaptation of Hound, which is the meeting on the moor, because Watson's, you know, seen this mysterious man but not realised that it was Holmes. So he finds this man's lair and they meet on the moor, and Holmes takes off his disguise. So we don't get that scene. Because in the canon story, it's a scene where I always think, you know, Watson, you should be so angry at Holmes for pulling that stunt on you. Like, you've wasted all this time and effort. And, you know, so we don't have that scene, obviously, but what we get instead, I thought, fits much better with the modern update. No, so, I mean, obviously, having Sherlock there, we have to have Sherlock there for various reasons in the modern update. But I like to think that one of the reasons is that this modern version just can't pull that kind of stunt on this John Watson. This John Watson wouldn't just go off to Dartmoor because Sherlock says so. So, yeah, that's my very, very brief similarities and differences to the canon, set the mood. And now I'm going to hand over to Curly.
Oh, good. Okay. Baskervilles has got, I think it's 8.4 million is the moment, and that'll obviously go up as iPlayers add it to that. So it's been very well received, generally. Some of the reviews have said they actually like Scandal better, which I thought was interesting. I mean, they both have, they're both very, very different. I think in general, we are all very pro Hounds of Baskerville. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Yep, definitely pro.
I found that I had to rewatch it a second time to fully appreciate everything because I had critics when I watched it once. And then watching it again, I could see things with a different eye. So yeah, I just rewatched it, which is very handy before the podcast. So perfect.
Yeah, I rewatched it again last night at like 2 a.m., which is not a good idea because when I first watched it, like I didn't jump at all. But when I was alone in my bed at like, say around like 2:30, I definitely jumped and I kind of screamed at one point. So don't do that.
Yeah, when I watched it with my friends, I had already seen it and they hadn't, so it was a lot of fun watching them react by jumping and curling in the ball and things. When I knew what was happening.
I watched it last night and then this morning again, but I didn't really sleep because I just kept giggling to myself.
So we're going to go through this, like, our last episode chronologically. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who listened to last one. I think it's around 1,400 people have listened to our Scandal episode. 1,455 on Podomatic.
Wow.
So, thanks, guys!
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
This one is not nearly as controversial, I don't think. There's, like, 2 points that have been sort of prior contention, but we'll talk about them when we get there. Starting off, we get this lovely little montage of a poor little boy seeing his father ravaged and ripped apart and screaming at a poor, adorable little puppy.
And then we get Russell Tovey with absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
Already. Yes. Just 2 seconds before the credits, and he's already in, and it's like, okay, this is going to be good.
Very impressed with Tovey.
Yeah.
He plays that sort of wounded, poor character very well, but it wasn't over the top. Like, there have been some critics who say that he overacted it a lot, which I don't really think. I think he did a good job at portraying like sort of like the complete like unwinding of his mind to the point of the complete epic breakdown, which happens to a lot of people in this episode.
I think you would think he's overacting until you realize why. Once you reach the sort of denouement of the episode and you understand what's actually happening to him, you can see the reason for it, so I wouldn't put that out as a criticism.
Well, I think in the beginning, when he first shows up at Baker Street, I mean, he seems to be a bit out of it. I mean, kind of over the top. But then it just makes so much sense after a while. So even if it seems too much in the beginning, it still, you know, it still portrays it really, really well, like in hindsight.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because I'm used to see him in another TV show, and I'm really used to see him on TV. And I know how he is and how he acts, but I thought he was spot on immediately. I mean, this kind of freaked out guy who is a bit in some kind of daze because he doesn't know what's going on and he's just confused. He's just reaching out for homes because it's his, basically his last hope. I don't know, I thought he worked really well. I really, really liked Russell Tovey. I thought he was brilliant. Well done.
And, I mean, poor Henry as well because Sherlock's completely off his rocker at this point because he's just completely manic. Without a case, craving cigarettes like crazy. We say, again, sort of bring in that addiction and drug illusion, which I really like that they're touching on quite a lot this series. So he's already just like, meh, and then here comes poor dejected Tovey.
Can we just mention the pig and the harpoon first? Because that was quite an entrance, I have to say. That was just brilliant. I was so not expecting that. And then, canon!
Sherlock takes the case because he says hound. Archaic word. Very odd. And then, for a period of time, I thought they were going to go with John having to go by himself because Sherlock's kind of like, no, no. And then you realize that he's just trying to get his cigarettes off of John.
Yeah, because that was pretty much out of canon because, I mean, the whole thing, and he's saying, I'll send my best man, and touching his arm, that's exactly out of the actual story. Mm-hmm. And then he just changes his mind, just like that. I love that part.
I'm glad that Sherlock went, because, I mean, this is still very much so John's episode, but I'm glad that Sherlock's there more than he is in the actual story.
And then Sherlock drives.
Yes, because Martin Freeman can't drive.
Yeah, because Martin Freeman drives.
Yeah, when he first came out, I'm like, why is Sherlock driving? And then when I saw Gatiss' tweet saying, Martin can't drive, like, oh, okay, well, that answers that question.
Yeah, but My only question is, what happens when you get distracted by sheep or something? I mean, you know.
Maybe not the best person to trust with the car, you're saying?
Sheep!
Okay.
Oh my god.
To see the beautiful Devon countryside, which I'm quite... I really want to go there. Because it does sort of have that sort of creepy but pretty quality to it. And you just expect bad things to happen there.
Yeah. So you want to go there. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Then we get into this lovely little pub. Vegetarian pub. Holla.
And the undershow reference!
Yay!
That was so nice.
It was really lovely. And then, like, when I saw it, I was kind of like, nyar! Like, I just made this weird noise, and I just kind of kept it to myself.
I yelled at my computer.
It was, like, the first thing I capped after it stopped. I'm like, I have to cap this right now and put this up right now, because it's just a little nod. And it made me happy, because it's like, oh, Mark, thank you, that's so sweet. People keep in their subconscious there.
I like the fact that there's this old scene in the bar, there is a lot of John Watson asking questions. Like, he's already, you can see that he's getting used to being, to do investigation with Sherlock. And I just love how he just gets in, start asking questions, like, all casual and everything. Sherlock is just looking around, not saying a word, but John is in control already, and just, like, asking and everything. I think it's a nice touch to see how it becomes kind of a proper duo working together. Yeah. And I think it really shows in that episode how much John is important for the investigation as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like you can definitely see that somewhere along the line they've worked out that if someone's going to have to talk to people, it's going to have to be John.
You start to see a divergence of their investigative styles, because obviously Sherlock is always going to be able to tell a lot of stuff just by looking around, but John is going to have to take a more direct approach, and it's obviously he's more comfortable with that he's willing to ask more questions, and maybe he'll eventually arrive at the same conclusion.
For sure, and that shows, because John's asking the questions. Sherlock's looking around, he overhears, and that's when he goes to see Fletcher, which another lovely little reference, Fletcher Robinson, who gave Doyle the idea for Hound of the Baskervilles.
The bet was a really nice touch, too, as well. That was out of the blue carbuncle.
Yeah. Sherlock knows he has to sort of put on his game face for this, so he just, like, steals a pint from this table, and he just, like, goes over. And then he's got this weird sort of personality thing going on, saying, like, they're, like, on holiday or whatever. Part of what I loved about them being outside of London, that they are outside of their comfort zone, so they sort of have to adapt to what's sort of around them and, like, have to talk to people a different way. So really appealing to, you know, the barkeeper, the innkeepers, with their nice little jabs of the snoring and stuff. And then Sherlock and Fletcher playing him in a different way, saying, oh, I bet you can't prove it. I bet this guy 50 quid. And then, you know, John gets 50 quid for free.
That's
nice.
I was so happy that John called him on that and was just like, you 50 quid, you said?
I thought that was one of the strengths of this episode, that was that John was just taking nothing from, I mean, he was just jumping at any chance he could, like, getting Sherlock back, so I love that he just went right with it.
I would just like to put out a massive shout out to all the incidental characters in this episode, because I thought they were all really great. And it's something that I really love about the Granada show is that, you know, no matter how small a part the actors got in it, they all made the most of it. And so all the incidental characters are really great. And I thought that was really, I mean, it was like that in Scandal as well. There was this ginger police officer who had like 2 seconds of screen time, and everyone was like, oh my god, he's awesome.
The 200 of the bar as well. They were just so peculiar. Like, they just have like pretty much 5 minutes on screen, and they make such a mark in being amazing. So that was really cool. I totally agree. Nice choice. Also in Baskerville, I mean, we can talk about it later, but all the people in Baskerville are, like, very, very unique. Like, you really remember them. Like, the corporal is very, very unique as well.
And pretty.
It's good. Yeah, another one of those, the pretty extra. They're really good at that in Sherlock BBC, right?
They are, the pretty extras.
Is it a rule, like, you can't be in Sherlock unless you're above a certain amount of prettiness?
That is criteria for casting. But they go to Baskerville next, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. So, breaking in with my cross card.
Well, let's talk about John Watson for a minute.
Please. Because,
excuse me.
Pulling rank.
Like, that's pretty much something most of us not what some fans have been expecting for about a million years. That was brilliant. I have to say I had a bit of a flailing moment when he did that, and also how completely confident he is about doing it. Just perfect. Thank you so much for that. It was just brilliant.
Yeah,
I think that was my favorite bit.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, me too. I admit it was mine as well.
And it's something else that they're bringing into this series in particular. They're really drawing in on like their backstories and stuff, because really in the first series you didn't get a whole lot of John actually being like a doctor or an ex-army, but they're really pushing it this series, and I think it's really great, and it's really bringing out like more of their personalities as characters and also the relationship with each other.
Yeah, and you see it a lot where how John is, you know, around with people in this episode as well, how protective he is, how he goes into doctor mode as well a few times. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very relevant to show that John is this kind of social anchor about, you know, he can talk to people and he can also have this kind of snappy reaction like pulling rank or just being the doctor. He has this kind of multifunction thing around Sherlock on so many levels. It's really cool.
I really like the whole pulling rank and then the way he was with the people in Baskerville, because it's just like it shows so much. It's kind of a counterpart of Sherlock acting, you know, to try and get at what he wants. John can't do that to that extent, but in that environment, he knows exactly how these people work. Like, if you have a pretty small corporal who is a bit narky and who doesn't do what you want, you pull rank, and then things work. And, you know, if he just asks the right questions, he knows how to push these people's buttons, both because he's a doctor and he's an ex-army officer, and he kind of shows up Sherlock in that environment almost, because he just knows how these things work.
I love particularly the scene after the alarms had been set off, where Sherlock's telling him it must be like a computer glitch, and John, like, completely just blank face tells the guy that'll be going in the report as well.
that is brilliant.
Because he's still playing up with their inspectors who are there. He's like, computer glitch, that's going in the report. Just even though they're basically already caught.
A funny part of that earlier, when they're talking about the rabbit, he's like, you're going to tell me that we broke into a top-secret army base because of a rabbit?
I love those little remarks that he constantly makes. Like, are we getting caught in here? You know, he's just so sarcastic all the time, but kind of in a way that he knows that whatever's going to happen, he's still going to go with it. But he, you know, he will still remark on it, and he will still speak his mind. I love that about him.
Yeah, the whole, we're here to look around your secret base. Oh, fine, come on in, we've just put the kettle on, right?
Yeah, exactly. I just love that. People do it, but he will let you know that he's not okay with it.
Yeah, this is something that Mark really got right writing this, is that in the stories, Watson doesn't make a whole lot of jokes, but when he writes about things, you can tell there's sort of like a, not necessarily a comedic aspect, but he's being snarky, and they really play that very well in this series, because he knows how to joke, and he's like, this is completely ridiculous, this is my life right now, I am allowed to make jokes about it. And they do that really well.
I found that this episode was actually a kind of comedic in a way. The way it was done, the structure of it, I thought it had a bit of a continuity thing, but it has this kind of nice meat that you can find in comedy sometimes, even if there was a lot of drama as well. I kind of like the fact that it was very snarky all the time. Like, there were just little things that, just when they come out of Baskerville, and John comes out and say, oh, don't do that, like, you put your coat up and you just look with your cheekbones and everything. I was like, this is brilliant. This is one of the best dialogue ever. It's like, he's literally making fun of Sherlock, like, dude, I know exactly what you're doing here, looking all cool and suave, and it's not working, you know? I know your tricks. And this shows so much how it knows him now. It's brilliant.
Yeah, and he doesn't even have to say it. I mean, it's just in the beginning, when they get out of the car and go into the inn, he's just looking at Sherlock, and Sherlock's just like, what, it's cold?
Yeah.
You know, cold. They're already functioning that way. It's crazy.
We should talk about Stapleton, because, for one, I was really happy they made her a woman.
Yeah.
I thought that was a nice touch. I'm a little sad that she didn't end up being the villain, but I do like what they did at the end, so it was okay. But the glowing bunny was a nice little touch, and sort of going to that whole naturalist, like, thing that Stapleton actually was. Nice little link there, but
I really liked that she wasn't the baddie, because, you know, if you watch this show as a Holmesian or as someone who's read Hand of the Baskervilles, the name Stapleton falls and you just go, all right, okay, Stapleton, she makes Joan the Dark animals, right, here we go then, that's the solution.
Yeah.
And it's not.
That's true.
It's nice. It's really, really nice. Because everyone's done Hand of the Baskervilles, and I spent quite a lot of time watching quite a lot of versions of it, and it gets kind of tired after a while, because you know what happens. So having a version where you don't know what happens was very, very refreshing.
That is a good point. I concede.
It's like a built-in red herrings, which is awesome.
Yeah. With Franklin being the ultimate baddie. With his cell phone instead of his mobile.
Americans again. It's impressive.
Yeah, and again, in the context of adaptations, Franklin and the whole subplot surrounding him quite often gets cut because it doesn't really lead anywhere and doesn't really hugely connect to the main plot, so that was really neat as well.
So we're off to, they actually go back to the house, and then they have the conversation about Liberty Inn,
yes.
I think. So they, Sherlock very nicely suggests to go back to where this guy has his worst trauma.
Yes, of course. And just see if something attacks him.
Let's just go there and just use you as a bait. Yay!
And Sherlock. That is exactly from the canon. That was Holmes' brilliant plan in the canon. They had a very close shave with that arm, you know.
I know, but with the modern times, and considering the guy is so traumatized, it was quite fun they actually went there nonetheless. I liked it.
It's like, because both Henry and John are like, what? That's your plan?
And then you have this amazingly directed sequence where they actually go there, and you have all this glorious, magnificent shot. Director of photography of Sherlock, let me love you. It was absolutely beautiful. And just the walking with this, you know, the shades and everything, it was just beautiful. It gives such a nice atmosphere to the episode. It was absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, they just go there.
Yeah, and they're really good at setting
the
scenes.
And John sees the boss.
Yes.
The boss code. That was just so funny.
Umkra.
I was not expecting Umkra. That at the end. When
at first, I thought it was referencing
Selden.
Selden, there you go. I thought that's what they were doing. I'm like, ooh, are they adding that into there? But I think that's probably what everyone is expecting. And then when he gets there and there's just a bunch of people having sex and watching, I'm like, that's really funny.
I still find it tremendously funny that things like that in Great Britain are called a dogging site. I'm like, yeah, I can see what you did there, Mark.
Oh, yeah. But it's called?
It's called dogging.
Yes. It's called a dogging site, yes. So. Can I just say about the Morse code, I really, really liked that John got the white on-screen text, which is usually visually reserved for Sherlock deductions. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like saying, yeah, they're a unit now.
Yeah.
And that just made me tremendously happy. Like, my friend had to cope with quite a lot of my flailing when we were together.
Okay, so going back to Super Scary Time.
Grimpen.
John's wandering around, and, like, the moment, I just love that, like, that shot, because it happened earlier with Henry, it's like, it's close up on them, and then when they see it or they hear it, like, it sort of zooms back up, and it's just a brilliant shot, and it really just, like, unsettles you. It's the look on Sherlock's face. You're just like,
yeah.
There's a lot of, like, really good subtle acting in this. Like, there's some that we can talk about that some people think is overacting, but there's a lot of really good subtle acting in this.
Yeah.
Especially to Dick.
It's so tense to show them and not what they're actually seeing. It gives you this feeling of, like, claustrophobic horror to see their sort of expression change.
Well, it's like so much like the movie Jaws, where you don't see the shark till the very end. So the whole time it's the music and the cinematography and the reactions that build that sense in you of horror.
Well, this is the best cinema trick in the world. What you feel the most is what you can't see. So from the moment you don't see it, you can build up a whole suspense for a TV show or a movie. I thought it was really smart to not show anything, even the hint of eyes or something. You could barely see the shadow of the beast, you know, in that scene. So that was really good. I loved it. I thought it was very atmospheric.
So obviously after that, trying to calm Henry down because John's like, what the hell is wrong with the two of you? So they calm Henry down, but in the pub scene, which I think is really telling for Sherlock's character, personally, because he's completely losing his shit. Like,
yes.
He can't understand it, and I wrote, like, this thing about it, which I won't read into it, but it's just talking about, like, how he doesn't know how to deal with, like, this intense of emotions, especially fear, and how he clarifies later, like, doubt. It's like, there's nothing wrong with me. Like, he physically cannot handle it, and he's just can't deal with that at all. Like, he's drinking, he's shaking, and part of this is obviously the drugs, but another, I think, probably larger part of it is him just unable to focus and rationalize what is actually happening, what he had just seen.
He retreats into his, like, analysis there. I particularly noted that down. Like, he retreats into his abilities, like this hyper-analysis thing to try, like, re-rationalize his brain, but it doesn't really work.
So what I find really interesting is that it still works. I mean, like, his mental, you know, ability to analyze still works, even though he's kind of having this breakdown at the same time. I find that really interesting. So it's not that one thing kind of stands in the way of the other. It's just, it seems to be two separate entities.
Well, the thing is, I didn't like the scene the first time I saw it. I want to be the devil's advocate here, because I was one of the people who... It's not that I didn't like it. It's that I just thought there was something off with it. And I think seeing it again, with a different context, it gave me a different eye on it, which is two things. Sherlock is an addict, so he would react as an addict because he's under the influence of narcotics as well. So he's manic, but he doesn't
know he's manic.
I
didn't even think about that.
Oh my
God.
Well,
I think of it. I thought of it. I think it's actually interesting. It's actually interesting because he's an addict and he's under the influence of something, but he doesn't know he has been given something.
Mm-hmm.
So he's having a reaction that is not something he can be. Usually when an addict wants to have that reaction, he knows he's doing it, at least at the start. Whereas in that situation, he doesn't know. So he's an ex-addict. He has a reaction to narcotics. So he's losing his shit, which is one thing. The second thing is that, I think because I talked about it on the internet and a lot of people reacted to it, what I got from some people, which was really interesting, was many people think Sherlock is really tense. And John mentioned in that scene that he's been completely bizarre recently. And I think it is somehow also a build-up to Sherlock being on the edge, you know, completely, for going to Reckonback as well, which is Sherlock being, like, on the edge because he thinks something is going to happen. And so everything that is not fitting the little boxes, as usual, is making him lose his crap, basically. So I thought it was really interesting. So everything you've said before, I completely agree now that I've seen the scene again. But adding that on top, which is the ex-addict reaction to a narcotics he doesn't know about, plus the stress and the angst, makes complete sense now that I've seen it a second time. So that's what I wanted to say, because first time wasn't a winner immediately for me. So yeah. Voila. Yeah,
very good points. No, I didn't even think about the narcotic thing. Like what you just said about him wondering, like, the oncoming storm of what's happening, and that's definitely touched on later when they're in the Hollow again and he thinks he sees Moriarty. Like, he is terrified of what's happening with Moriarty. He's terrified of what's happening, like, in general.
Yeah.
Like, his entire life is being messed up, and now he's, like, thinks he's seen this dog, and he's just like, what the f***?
Scandal. I mean, that's kind of, we had this kind of, well, whether you want to call it emotional confusion or whatever, I mean, he has been out of his depth, theoretically, in the last episode. So he knows that he kind of reacts differently in certain contexts. So I think that kind of plays nicely into this, you know, in John saying that he's kind of been different and on the edge lately.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a reference to it as well.
I mean, it's quite interesting, the reaction. I mean, it's a scene we can talk about for a while, but it's interesting the reaction of people about John. Some people think that John is just standing there and just listening and not really understanding what's going on. Some people think it's only fair that John would be a bit put off by the whole thing. And some people thought that John was actually very harsh because he wasn't trying to understand Sherlock. I think it's a bit of both. I think, you know, you have to give it to that man that he's been pretty patient all this time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fairly unusual reaction of Sherlock. So I don't see it as something harsh. I see it more as some kind of like, okay, that's it, you know, that's, I can't deal with that crap right now, so you calm down and I'm going out. So I don't know. He wasn't harsh to me. He was pretty much a safe, like, fair reaction, I'd say.
Yeah. It was understandable that he reacted that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was also, like, Sherlock was completely failing to explain what was going on with him, but he was also, he was so out of it that he didn't actually want any help. And I think, you know, coming from, I mean, we don't actually know what John's medical background is, but I'm starting to think it's either because he's been in therapy or because he has some kind of knowledge in psychology that he does the things he does, especially in basketball. So it's kind of like if you're in that kind of setting and somebody really, you know, tells you, leave me alone, then the best thing you can do is leave the situation and just, you know, leave them to calm down and sort themselves out and come back after a while. So there's that as well.
And then there's that really sort of like awkward, sad, slightly funny scene the next morning when Sherlock knows he has to apologize, but he doesn't quite know how. And he, like, goes up, he's, like, trying to, like, make conversation. And John is just, like, he's still, I don't know if he's just really still put off, if he's worried. I'm inclined to go with worried because he went and he was talking to Dr. Mortimer, when Charlotte, you know, sent him a picture. Three continents, Watson.
this whole season is about Three Continents, Watson, right? Because there is allusion to John being a ladies' man every 10 minutes, almost. Is that what?
Brilliant. Sherlock knows this, and he uses it.
Oh, yeah, it's brilliant. He just love, like, ooh, I'm going to send him a picture. And John immediately says, like, ooh, you bad man.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
It's just, yeah, like what you guys said in the last episode, you know, if you want John Watson doing anything, send a pretty girl. Or even a picture of
a pretty
girl.
You know? Dangle the promise of a pretty girl like a carrot.
But then, of course, she thinks he's gay because Franklin shows up and says his live-in PA, and she's like, live-in, and she leaves. And it's like, and John's like, God, you know what?
But that's such a smart move from Franklin, and that's just brilliant. Because he comes just across as bad timing, but, I mean, that's obviously, you know, very well-timed, that interruption.
Yeah, premeditated interruption.
So then where do we move to?
We're back to the awkward attempting to apologize, and then when John just keeps walking away, like, one of my favorite moments is just the look of, like, despair on Sherlock's face. He's like, John, does the amazing line that I'm so happy
you're
that you're in. That
yes.
You're, oh, maybe your conductor of light. Like, yes!
Did we mention also the whole creepy psychological harassment made on Henry with the light and everything? That was a creepy, creepy scene, though. That would freak the hell out of me, like, seriously. The whole light in the garden. It was horrible. I fell for him, like, really, you know. I was like, oh my god, what is wrong? It's horrible. Help. I did watch the episode in the dark, by the way, so I was, like, with my headphones in the dark, and I was just jumping, bouncing on the bed, like, 5 years old. It was brilliant.
I like that Henry has, like, security lights that are roughly as bright as a stadium lights.
Yeah.
Russell played that awesome, I thought, to give him some props, because it was just him having these freaky experiences, and I thought he really, really sold that right there.
Yeah, it was really good.
But he's really good at playing, like, a guy who's a bit scared about a lot of things. I mean, he plays a werewolf in another show, so, you know.
He's very good at playing a kick puppy.
Oh, yeah. Aww. That pun intended.
But no, like, they handled the sort of, like, psychological trauma very well. I feel. And it went on to do with that, like, you can't see it, like, you couldn't see the hound again, but it was just the reaction of the lights, which could have triggered him thinking that there was something out there, and then, of course, he's seeing things, because he's all drugged up and shit.
And then we have Lestrade!
Lestrade!
Yay!
That was the best entrance ever. Oh
great.
My god, that was brilliant.
What the hell are you doing here?
So much thing in it. We finally find out his name is Greg, which is pretty much a final fact.
Figured to tell you my name.
I just love that. It just shows again that Sherlock isn't completely humanized because he doesn't know Lestrade's first name. He's like, calling yourself Greg. He's like, that's his name. It is? Yes!
That was amazing. And also, Lestrade is in touch with Mycroft, which is a bit of a new thing as well.
There's
on many levels, but a new thing.
Yeah. I think it was a good reason to get him there, because in the story, Lestrade is there for kind of no reason. So it was a clever way for him to actually be there, I think, for him to have a reason.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone wants to bet Rupert Graves when he comes back from holidays like that. Just put him in the show or whatever. I just have to talk for Jen because she's not around for the podcast today.
Jen did require us to talk about Lestrade.
Yeah, you did promise. Made us promise.
So we are talking about Lestrade and we are talking about Rupert Graves.
I really enjoy
because Rupert
Graves
is good at football
comments.
And has five children.
Okay, moving on.
Aw, but do we have to? Okay.
Lestrade is single. Should we say that? Like, the ongoing thing about his wife cheating on him? He's not wearing his wedding ring.
Yeah. No, he wasn't.
Okay.
I didn't notice this. So, do we get another little sort of canon nod? Sort of. Like, the keeping of the dog in, like, a back shed sort of thing. Because the Undershaw meat suppliers were sending them meat for a vegetarian restaurant.
Which is a bit unusual.
Yes.
I like the guy trying to cover it up too and being like, I had a bacon sandwich.
They just couldn't stop.
So I think we can all agree that John has met his match in worst liar ever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. That's just not going to fly, mate.
What I really enjoyed after that is Sherlock is the apology coffee. Which we
oh my
all...
god. Which is not really an apology coffee.
It's not an apology coffee.
What a devious little man.
But I cannot believe this.
I like that John notices that it's got the sugar in it, but then just continues to drink it anyway.
I know, because he thinks that Sherlock is apologizing. And he's like, you don't have to keep apologizing, but it's fine, I'll drink it, it's okay.
You'd think he'd be more suspicious by now.
Yeah, but it just shows again that he just does everything Matt Sharp wants from him. Like, seriously, he will drink that coffee just to make him feel better, even if he doesn't even know that, you know, it's something completely different behind it. But he'll just do it just to...
I mean, in the end, the sugar, it's not the sugar, so technically it was an apology coffee.
Accidental
apology coffee.
I need a mug that says that.
Okay, I'll put that up. So,
and then we go back to Baskerville, right?
Yeah, and this scene is like the scene.
Oh. Yeah.
Well,
because
yeah.
It's basically the equivalent to the meeting of the moor, except it is the way it is.
Like, I think I can speak for everyone that the hearts were just, like, wrenching for John, because you see, like, this army man, he's a soldier, and reduced to, like, complete terror.
Yeah.
And I think it was... like, that little sound, and then he covered his mouth, that completely ripped your heart out, and he was like, oh my god.
Bless you, Martin Freeman, bless you, because that was just another really, really, really great scene. It was just so intense, and especially, you know, even if you have doubts about if it's real or not, especially at the end, there is still this thing that is just working, it's just completely terrifying. I had a bit of an opinion about that, but everyone keeps pushing it away and telling me it's irrelevant, so I'm not sure I'm going to talk about it. But I was just thinking that, you know, even if at the end of the day, John comes back from the army, he's been hurt, and he had PTSD after he came back, and that Sherlock says that the adrenaline and investigation makes him kind of stop having PTSD, I couldn't help but thinking that, you know, in a way, someone with PTSD kind of have it for the rest of his life, and in a way, even if it had nothing to do with the weapon or with the guns or anything, I was like... maybe at one point John shifted, you know, it's fine, everything is fine, and then suddenly the terror that invades him is just not only that terror, it's everything. Because he has fear before in his life, he has had that terrifying thought of dying, and it's, you know, that's what PTSD is about. So I was just thinking about that, thinking, you know, he has a history of PTSD, so it's actually stronger than in the canon because it's related to modern life. And I was wondering if it was a bit of a nice throwback to that. But everyone keeps telling me it's irrelevant, so...
And I think, I mean, I might be imagining things, but whenever Sherlock's firing a gun around him, he always pulls his left shoulder back. So that might or might not have to do with that as well.
I think it does carry, you know, people with PTSD carry something with them forever. So when you have terror of death, you can be really strong for a long time, and then suddenly you're just gonna snap, you know, you're just gonna be like falling back into that place where you're terrified. And I was wondering if, you know, you can see John in that scene. He's okay. And then suddenly he just switch. He just go into that place where that's it. He's terrified and he has to hide and he's gonna die.
Yeah, and it's when the sound start, I think. The growling. Yeah.
And I think it's very snarky from Sherlock. It's very Sherlock, because probably Sherlock knows him well and he knew when to do that as well. You know, there is this kind of subtext about that which is very interesting. But again, maybe I'm just extrapolating too much.
No, I think it's a valid opinion, because he's, like, in his mind, he's being hunted, which is, like, when you're in war, like, the other side is hunting you in a way, so I could definitely see that connection. A lot of people have actually gotten very angry at Sherlock for doing this experiment, but I think it was a very necessary thing to do. Like, what Maria was saying, that he needed to test it on a normal person's mind, but also because he needed to be sure, because he told Barrymore about this. He's like, because if he got this wrong, it's like obviously a big thing. But he's like, if this is a hallucinogenic drug that someone's been feeding Henry all this time, then it is a really big deal. So he had to be sure. And he knew that John would be safe because he was taking care of him. And like when he went to go and like, you know, rescue him or whatever, he's saying like, it's okay, calm down, it's okay. And of course, John is, like, completely beside himself in terror, just like Henry was, just like Sherlock was. So it sort of establishes that this drug has the same effect on everybody.
Yeah. And also he can't trust John, you know? He knows that if John goes crazy, it's a sign that he has a proof that something is going on. Mm-hmm. Because John is the only man he can trust, probably, as well. So
I feel like that serves a wider purpose for Sherlock's character, because I feel like in Scandal, we saw Sherlock doing a lot of quote-unquote nice things that maybe were a little more human. We saw some of his, sort of the fact that he's evolved in his, you know, maybe John has had a good influence on him. But this kind of brings it back to the fact that Sherlock is not like everyone else. He's going to treat people in a way that we wouldn't necessarily expect. And so I feel like it really helps to reestablish that sort of tension and that balance of, okay, he's John's friend, but he's still Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, the work still comes first.
I just really like the whole role reversal kind of thing that they had going on through that whole sequence. Like, first when they were at the fireplace and John was like, you have to be rational about this. And then it was Sherlock who rescued John and said, it's alright, you're going to be okay. Which is normally, you know, John's job to rescue people and tell them they're going to be okay, because that's what John does. So I really, really liked that, but that's just because I'm an absolute sucker for role reversal. Yeah,
no, it ticked
all my boxes, basically.
What is after that?
It's the going to the... with the...
go and see Stapleton and go hang out in the Mind Palace.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Mind Palace. Here we go.
Which was trending on Twitter. It was trending.
I love the Mind Palace because I have a friend who can do exactly the same thing, and it was really close to that. Like, the entire movement sequence, there was just really... I don't know, I know, Marie, that you don't quite agree with that. Well, with the acting part of things, but that friend of mine who does that, like, he looks just like that when he does that, and he can kind of actually go back and remember these things.
It is interesting. A lot of people have come out saying, like, I know people who do this, like, or I do this, like, so it's not, like, a ridiculous thing, and it's actually based off of a ancient Roman technique. This is, like, really dorky.
Yay, I was gonna say that! Yay!
Yeah, it's based off of an ancient Roman technique of memorization. It's called a memory palace, and it's sort of like, it's like what you do, like, you categorize things in, like, a house inside of your head. So it goes, I think, very well with Sherlock's character, because in the canon, like, he would just be quiet for a very long time, and, like, he's searching through his mind. So maybe there weren't, like, the actual, like, movements, but this was something that people do nowadays. And it is an actual thing. Like, this isn't something that Kate has made up or anything.
Explaining it, because he does that in the Musgrave ritual, he explains how Sherlock actually goes back and tries to figure out things.
And it gave us another reason for the text on screen that wasn't just the way that we've seen it before. It was like a new use of the words on the screen, which was fun.
It was Paul McGuigan going like, text on screen for everything!
And Elvis.
And Elvis. That part actually made me laugh really hard.
Yeah, well, the only reason I didn't like it the first time, because again, I'm the only one on the podcast who didn't like it the first time, so I think I should mention it. I love the idea on principle, and I know about this whole, you know, the mind palace thinking that he's mentioning. There is the synesthesia as well, which is the one with the color blocks and everything, which is used by other characters on TV, like Spencer Reed in Criminal Minds. And all this stuff is very, you know, it's the thing, I've seen it and I totally understand it. I think it was just because I was expecting it to be a bit more subtle in a way it was done, more like I think it's an acting choice or probably a directing choice. And there was a lot of arm movements and head movements going into something, which I thought was a bit weird. On second viewing, it went better, but I'm still, I like it, I don't love it, so it's my opinion again. But I do love the idea. I do think it's completely fitting for Sherlock. That's a no-brainer for me. It works so well. It's just the way it's shown, which is a bit strange to me, but that's my opinion.
Yeah, and you are perfectly allowed to have that.
Oh,
it has become sort of like a thing of contention. Like, in the reviews, it's like people either like it or they don't. Like, there's no sort of hazy in the middle sort of thing. Which I think
there is me now.
Yes, there's me. Marie is a lone person who's kind of like
a middle. I'm alone. There is an island in the middle and I'm standing on it and I'm like, dude, I kind of like that. But yeah.
I think visually it's very stunning. Very beautiful. It annoyed me that they kept moving fonts around, but that's because I'm like OCD about fonts. But I think it's another just way of us seeing how Sherlock's mind works. Because you can't really portray that on screen. You can't. But this is the way that they've invented that you can do that. So it's him going through all like these different things. And then the Americans are responsible for everything again.
Oh, we always are.
Always.
was it a British man who went to Indiana?
Yes.
Yeah, but
this is where my one whole problem in the whole episode came up, and it wasn't really that big of a problem. It was actually more funny to me, I think. But they show this picture of all these people working for Hound, and it comes back later on that they all, for some reason, have what I would like to refer to as the secret government matching T-shirts.
Yes.
I mean, they like raise money for it, like you do in band camps,
selling lollipops.
Get their matching Hound. Sorry, it just cracked me up. I was like, really?
So they get to do this cool little thing at the computer where they're trying to hack into using Barrymore's information.
It's Minority Report. It's Minority Report.
I have never seen this movie. I don't know.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, no. That's why you can't get the reference. There is it's massive Minority Report thingy in there, right there. So, yeah. Definitely Minority Report. Am I the only one who saw that, or is it just, you know?
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Have you seen the movie? Who's seen the movie?
No.
I have seen it, but it's ages ago, so.
You know, when it's at the beginning of the movie, he has all this system, this futuristic system, when he has all this information coming up in front of a holographic screen in front of him, and he's just doing all stuff with his hands. It's exactly that.
I know what you're saying.
All right, okay.
That's it. We can move on.
So that happened. And then John gets a call from Dr. Mortimer that poor dear Henry has gone off his kilter. And, naha, I like how they balanced what was happening in his mind and what was happening in real life.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because obviously he thinks he's shooting at the Hound when in fact he's shooting at his poor dear therapist.
Yeah, that was
and
good.
The and question of why he has a gun.
Yes.
Yeah. His dad's mate, like Bob Franklin, works at like a super secret army facility. So you know, who knows what he might have felt to her army.
But then they also call Lestrade, who comes also with a gun. And this is where I mentioned the fact that Lestrade shouldn't have a gun because, as his police officer rank, he shouldn't have a gun.
But Mycroft probably gave him a gun.
Yeah, we said blame it on Mycroft.
On Mycroft.
Mycroft is the source of everything.
It's true. Yeah. It's true.
And then they just go and run to the woods.
Yeah, super dark, scary place. For quite a few moments, I did think that Henry was going to kill himself, do himself in, because I One, Russell Tovey played that very well. He played it very convincingly. Yes. It wasn't over the top because it just showed, like, he's very disgusted with himself. He was, I just tried to shoot someone. Like, right. I'm mentally, like, out there. Why the hell? Like, why is this happening to me? I should just end it.
Yes, but I like that they kept it, like, they did in front of him. Thank you so much.
Yes.
It was also a really, really tense scene. I mean, just, you know, John's response to that whole situation and Sherlock's response, and you have to bear in mind they're walking into that, you know, that gas, which makes people go crazy. So it was generally a very tense scene with everyone being really on edge, and then, you know, Sherlock saw Moriarty and all the rest of it. I thought it was, like, it could have been over the top, but I really liked it.
Can we for a second talk about the fact that Lestrade is kind of aiming and shooting at the dog, but he's not hitting, and then John just takes him out with one try?
Yeah.
And there's no
That's a good point.
I mean, like, Lestrade, he doesn't even question it.
Nice continuity.
And it also goes to show that Lestrade isn't used to having a gun. So.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of answers the question.
Yeah, that's true.
I still maintain that people who write a British TV show should know that people in Britain do not carry guns habitually.
This is not America.
I think the issue is just that there are so many guns in the canon that in order to write the stories in any convincing way, there have to be a lot of guns.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. There's
guns all the time. Everywhere.
Guns everywhere!
All the guns.
You know, as much as I'd be okay with Sherlock just punching everyone out, you know?
But, you know, I mean, with Henry, you know, you could have a gun, like, he could have tried to stab her, or I don't know. But,
yeah, that's true.
Okay, poetic license, and I'll grant him that, but yeah.
It's okay. But on a slightly more serious note, the fact that, and we talked about this before, and the fact that this gas induces fear, and it brings to life your fears, and the fact Sherlock sees Moriarty, that above everything else, he is afraid of what that man can do. And it's a perfect setup to the next episode of The Name We Will Not Mention. Mm-hmm. And
I cannot.
Oh, don't say that word.
Don't say that word. It's like Voldemort.
It's the episode that shall not be named. I think this is the fact that Moriarty shows up in the drug-induced fear of Sherlock is also a very good thing to kind of bring back all the elements from the rest of the episode as well. Like I was saying before, how he has his nervous breakdown in front of the fire and all this stuff. It does validate a lot of that moment. Mm-hmm. And I find it really interesting because that's where you realize that on top of trying to solving the case as it is, he has in the back of his mind this constant line thinking about the Moriarty situation forever and ever. He knows something is coming, and it's really freaky.
And he's genuinely
thinking. He is.
I mean, I think looking at the end of last series, you know that Sherlock is not afraid to die. He's not afraid of Moriarty maybe destroying him personally, but I think he's afraid of the unpredictability and the lengths Moriarty's willing to go to before he would kill him or whatever. Because we saw that he's willing to sacrifice himself just on a basic level, but Moriarty is so much bigger than that and so much more unpredictable.
Yeah, I have to say the Sherlock adaptation recently have gotten that right pretty well.
They have.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This is good. This is really good.
So, turns out it's just a poor puppy and it's not a real dog. No, well, it's a real dog, but it's not a, you know, rawr dog.
Not genetically modified.
Here you go.
Super dog.
Super dog.
Super dog. It's not super dog. Doggy of doom. Nah.
and the Grimpen minefield. Yeah, well, I just thought that was really nice because I knew the bad guy had to blow up in the Great Grumpen minefield because in the canon he sinks in the Great Grumpen mire, except that it wasn't stable to Neville's Parkland, which was nice. And, like, just looking back at it, the Great Grumpen minefield just seems like the perfect way to update the Great Grumpen mire into a modern age, and that's what I really liked about this episode, that there were just a lot of things in it where you looked at it and as a modern update of canon stuff, and you just went, yeah, you know, this just makes sense. You couldn't really see it any other way in the modern world, so that was really nice. The fog cracked me up no end in any world, because in the show they actually managed to amalgamate two things. One of them is the Devil's Foot, where you have the poisonous gas, or rather a plant that gets put in people's oil lamps and makes them hallucinate horrible things and go homicidal and kill people and then not remember it the next morning. And the other thing, in The Hound at the very end, when Holmes explains to Watson how everything came about, he actually says, because they had a very close shave with the dog, and he actually says, one of the things that I couldn't account for was the possibility of Southern fog. And I just find that immensely funny. And there's actually a scholar, I think Brad Keefover is it, who actually chides Holmes for that. And it's like, he should have known. He should have calculated the possibility of Southern fog. I'm just like, yeah. So, you know, that is kind of like a really, really nice reference. And for those of us who get it, it's slightly hysterical. Like, I did laugh because I just finished The Hound 3 hours before I saw the episode. That was nice.
So maybe we can go to the dinner, the lunch, mostly lunch, scene with John and Sherlock, where John kind of finds out about Sherlock making the mistake with the sugar, but also finds out he's been tricked, which is a bit of a controversial thing. I mean, some people think, depending on the reaction of John, some people are a bit pissed off that John does not react as strong as he could, and some people just don't really think it's a problem because John is used to Sherlock being completely crazy about this kind of stuff now.
Well, what I said is I think that highlights that not only is Sherlock sort of an unusual person, but John is as well, because he is willing to put up with this, and at this point in time, he's pretty used to the fact that Sherlock is gonna do these things. And I think also somebody else said that, you know, he realizes the reason for it. He understands that Sherlock doesn't do these things without a purpose. And also the fact that Sherlock also had been subjected to this, so he knew that it was not gonna have lasting damage. It's not like he put John through something that he hadn't been through himself.
This is true. And well, John kind of had his freak out moment in the lab already, so I mean, he kind of let off steam, and in a way that he's portrayed, he's not, I mean, he just, you know, he just says, he speaks his mind, and then it's done. And I think because he already kind of freaked in the lab and told Sherlock off, he didn't know back then, but I think that already took, you know, some of the pressure off. Then he was just kind of resigned to you know, accepting the fact that it had been just another thing that Sherlock had done to him.
Initially, I thought that John maybe should have been angrier because it was quite an intense scene, but it depends on kind of what you want to see, you know, what it did to him. Like, you just don't do that kind of stuff to your friend.
I'm still a bit angry.
Yeah, I mean, but after what everyone else said, like, I'm kind of like, okay. I mean, I still think he deserved a punch in the face, but then, like John, I always think that Sherlock deserved a punch in the face.
Yeah, but usually it's subject.
Yeah.
And I think that what's important is that Sherlock explained why he had to do it. He admits it to John. And I think probably John enjoys the fact that Sherlock got the sugar wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
More than anything else.
Yeah, it's true.
Makes up for everything else.
He kind of gets back at him by making him, like, admit that he was wrong, I guess.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, if you think about it, like, Sherlock says, I knew how this worked on a superior mind, I had to test it on an average one. But to me, that's just Sherlock really dressing it up, you know? And what he actually means is, I had to test this on someone who had experienced fear before, who had, you know, who has this whole emotional range that Sherlock just doesn't have.
And then we move to Moriarty.
Moriarty.
Which is basically, Moriarty is a fangirl and he's talking Sherlock.
I love it.
There you go, scene. there's been a surprising amount of, like, not necessarily controversy about it, but people not, I don't think, quite understanding about what the scene is about.
What I think is really interesting with Moriarty is that most of the time you would have a villain who would be quite either hiding or very discreet until the very final act, whereas Moriarty is desperately trying to infiltrate himself into the structure of Sherlock's life, of John's life, of Mycroft's life, and he's so obsessed about Sherlock, instead of hiding, he's just going out, he's just doing everything he can to be in it. Ooh, I think I'm gonna use that one. It's so overt, it's covert. Oh, you know?
Nicely
it's just
done.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's just, you know, he has this. Basically, what he's doing is that by being so much on the outside, he's covering up for everything he's planning, and that's probably his biggest weapon, because that's what he's planning. I mean, if we have to talk about the episode that shall not be named, it is about, you know, pretty much confronting Sherlock and using probably the thing you expect the less from Moriarty. But he's a bit of a show-off as well, so it kind of fits the profile. I don't know, I think it's going to be very interesting. I'm not ready. I'm just not ready.
And based on the ending and then the preview clip, I think it's very obvious that Moriarty has let himself be caught. Like, he has a big plan. Like, this is all part of his grand scheme of making us cry constantly.
Yes.
He feels no inferiority to Sherlock whatsoever. Like, he doesn't need to hide, because he feels like he's going to win. He's absolutely sure he's going to win. So he's like, basically, here I am, because I know that I can beat you. And I think that's Moriarty's attitude here.
Yeah.
This is exciting and very frightening, and I'm not sure I'm ready, and I don't want to talk about this anymore.
We're going to go to question time.
Yay!
Unless anyone else had any comments. Oh! I know one. We got the very epic line that has been maybe the most quoted Sherlock Holmes line of all time in this episode.
Yeah, I was very, very happy when that happened. I actually squealed quite a lot. Because someone on Twitter or somewhere had said before, we get one of Sherlock's most famous quotes in this episode, or one of the spoiler-free reviews, and I was like, oh, it's not going to be that one, is it? And it was. And I was like, I'm so happy now.
Yeah. We got two of them. Like, we got the Conductor of Light, and then we got the Impossible Truth as well.
Yeah, the Improbable Impossible one was the one that I meant.
Yeah. So exciting. Okay.
Yay!
So our first question is from Matthew Sherlock Jeans. I don't think that's your real name. Asking, do you think the rubbish CGI was on purpose to show that the hound was not real and all in the mind, or was it just a sloppy job?
Okay, can I answer that one? Is that okay?
Yes, you may, Marie.
Yes, please. Okay, I know the studio worked on that. It's a studio in London called The Mill, where they do a fairly good job most of the time. So I assume that if they went for something that is not realistic, it was probably a decision that, you know, they're so far gone in their crazy drug haze that there is absolutely no point making something realistic, because it's kind of a build-up of all, if you look at all the descriptions that are made along the episode, it's basically the end result of everything they've heard, which is a bit of everything. It's a crazy science fiction dog, more like a real dog at the end. So I think it was probably made on purpose. If it wasn't made on purpose, it's a bit sad. But I think it was. I don't know about you guys, but I think it was made on purpose. It wouldn't make any sense to have something very realistic.
No.
I think it's very bad on purpose, because it's actually Jim in a cheap fancy dress dog costume.
Because Jim Moriarty is behind everything.
Even the hound.
He is the dog.
Can I just mention something funny from the episode as well? When Sherlock is doing his whole super long deduction next to the fire, he actually said in French, "Cherche le chien." He said, "Blah blah blah, cherche le chien," which made me laugh. I was like, "Where the fuck? Why? What is happening here?
Usually
why
French?" Cherche le pomme. You know?
I don't know.
Because usually the concept is there's never a bad deed without a woman behind it. So basically look for the woman, and chercher la femme is kind of how people shorthand it in various countries.
Oh, okay.
So
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Obviously not in France, because, you know, you guys speak French already. But yeah, I know people definitely do it in German, and people do it in English as well.
But that's why it didn't make sense to me then.
Yeah, the more you know.
The more you know.
So the Doggy of Doom is actually Jim in a dog costume.
That's decided.
It's fact. But obviously it was made to look like how they had been envisioning it. Like, it's all in their imaginations. It wasn't meant to be realistic. It's really just a poor puppy. Wanted a hug. And then it died.
Wow, that's horrible.
Just move on.
Can we just move on now? I'm going to cry.
Okay, so this is a slightly more serious question, if you're ready for it, by Sarah Berman. They brought up in the episode, for a brief moment at least, that Sherlock may have Asperger's. What are your thoughts on this? Some sort of Asperger's, high-functioning sociopath, which he's done research on, or just a big jerk?
the thing I was thinking about when I heard that, so I thought it was Lestrade who said it, but it's actually John. And that's where in my brain I went a bit like, ooh, because John is a doctor, for fuck's sake. So I think just putting that judgment on Sherlock, like putting me in a box, even if it's for a laugh, I think it's a bit not good. I would have expected something a bit different from, you know, writing about this. And I think it's a topic that deserves to be treated seriously and not as a joke somehow, even if I know what they wanted to do with it. So I think...
No, I agree. I totally agree. What I said basically is, just getting down to it, Sherlock doesn't have the exact strengths and weaknesses of a diagnosis that we can sort of put our finger on, and it would be kind of silly of the show to try to do that. And so I really do agree with Marie that probably it wasn't the greatest choice of words, and I think it was a little bit silly. But I think Sherlock is in a class all by himself, and I don't think they meant anything serious by it. I don't think joking about it was in the best of taste, but yeah, I don't think that says anything terribly definitive about Sherlock as a character.
I mean, yeah. I agree that it's probably best not to bring it up, because there has been a lot of talk about, like, reviewers and analysts or whatever saying that he plays a slightly autistic Holmes, and I think Benedict himself has even said that, which I can understand, because it's what we perceive today as, like, hyper-intelligence, and it's not necessarily fair, but it is how it's generally perceived. I guess when I watched it, it was just John and Lestrade talking to themselves, and Lestrade was searching for a word, and John suggested it, maybe as a way to, it's the only sort of link that Lestrade could possibly make, because they don't quite know how to describe him. That's, I guess, my two cents on it.
Yeah, my thoughts on it are pretty much along similar lines of Marie and Amy, in that, but especially, like, I don't mind the word so much, but I really minded that it came from John, especially given how he acts in Scandal and how he acts in Baskerville, which sort of suggests that he has some kind of background in psychology, either because he had some psychology training or because he's been to therapy himself. But I would lean stronger towards the former, that he actually has some kind of psychology training. And, you know, he really should know better. So I really minded that it came from John.
Yeah, it was strange at this point.
And you made the comment about how sensory overload is an issue on the autism spectrum. So that adds another dimension to what Sherlock did to John. I think you said something about that, if that was the case.
Yeah, because if it was the case, then that is a really, really horrible thing to do to a friend, because if you have Asperger's, then what you get is sensory overload. And I mean, I don't have Asperger's, but, you know, I'm somewhere on the spectrum, and I know people on the spectrum, and I know what sensory overload feels like. And that was exactly what Sherlock did to John. And if he had that kind of diagnosis, then that is actually a really, really horrible thing to do to your friend.
Yes. So don't do that to your friend.
I suddenly wanted to put someone in a room and, you know, do this.
Turn on the lights.
Oh.
A slightly happier question. What did we think about the Cluedo bit on there? Because obviously the Cluedo board was stabbed to the mantelpiece in Scandal. And there, because Sherlock Holmes would be a horrible person to play Cluedo with, because he'd be overanalyzing everything, and, like, in the episode, saying, like, John's like, the victim can't be the murderer. He's like, it's the only possible solution.
Love that. I'm sure that it was John who actually put the board, actually knifed the board, because he was probably so frustrated with Sherlock, just being, well, Sherlock, that he probably just put it there in his rage.
Yeah.
I just liked how they kind of linked back to it at the very end of the episode, when Sherlock said this case has been, the scene of the crime has been the murder weapon as well.
Yeah.
You know, because that's something that's not in the rules of Cluedo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice point, actually.
That is a good point.
I didn't think of that. And I was going to mention something we didn't mention at the beginning, which is the very funny fact that the cigarettes were hidden under the skull, which is a good throwback to what we're talking about, which is tobacco.
Yeah, and also that...
thank you for smoking.
Thank you for smoking, and the slipper. They actually put that into there as well, which I thought was a very lovely touch. And
I have to say, I really adore the concept of John just getting so frustrated that he actually nails the clue board to the wall with the knife.
Yes, I love that.
It's just a really funny image.
Yeah, absolutely. Just imagine that. Just imagine them actually playing that. And then she just leaves. Because she said anyway.
Can I don't know if you've read John's blog recently, but John's blog, there is a comment in there where he talks about, especially after Baskerville, he talks about how Sherlock tried to drug his coffee, and he ends saying, "One day I'll kill him." And I think this is extremely relevant to our interest if we talk about the episode that should not be named.
But we're not going to.
Oh my god.
And I was like, why would you write something like that? You're going to regret it.
Well, they also referenced death a couple of times during the episodes, and it really did not make me happy.
They've built it up so much, with the relationship, with everything.
Well, maybe we can talk about the Super Moriarty video posted on John's blog as well.
Yes, John's blog has been hacked.
Yeah.
that was such a brilliant idea. Basically, as soon as the episode finished, John's blog was updated with a video of Moriarty breaking into 221B. And that kind of set the mood.
Just doing a little tour.
Yeah, and being all creepy and everything. What does he say? I knew him well.
The last poor Sherlock, I knew him well.
That was just creepy as hell.
Because on John's blog, I mean, Mrs. Hudson, she was constantly commenting from Mrs. Turner's computer, right? And at one point, John was answering her and, like, saying thank you or something. And then it was actually Mrs. Turner who was talking. She said that Mrs. Hudson is down at the cafe again. And that didn't make sense until we knew the reason why she would be down there.
Her little failed relationship's quite sad, actually.
And then I love that it kind of was on the blog before.
That's true.
So go to John's blog, it's been hacked, watch the video. It's a little bit creepy, but also kind of funny.
It's very Moriarty.
It's very Moriarty.
Yeah.
I have to make it rhyme. Couldn't stop myself.
So we answered some of the other questions, Lady Karasu and of Donut. Sagita sent in something that she was very happy about, the harpoon.
The infamous harpoon.
The harpoon from the Black Peters. And the fact that he went on the tube like that.
That's not possible. That's not possible. I'm sorry, but, you know, some of us live in London, and I would just... The guy couldn't even go through the Oyster card. He just couldn't. Does he actually own the Oyster card?
I don't think he does.
No. I think it just cheats. Yeah.
Well, let's think like how he could have gotten to Baker Street, regardless of where he is. The lines there are Bakerloo, Jubilee, the Circle, Hammersmith and City, Circle Line. That's possible.
Yeah.
Circle Line is kind of...
Is it that dodgy?
It's dodgy. It goes around the perimeter of the city. So he went on the Circle Line.
That's fun.
It's there you go. He just explained it to you.
It's just decided.
It's done. It's there.
I'm just so amused that he's actually using the tube.
I know, the fact that he actually went on the tube, because none of the cats chased him, obviously.
That fact alone is just hilarious.
Can you imagine him being all dramatic with his harpoon covered in blood, just turning around and just looking at people, you plebeian!
Exactly, and just like, blood everywhere.
When someone looked at him funny, he'd probably just say, like, you know, I'm an actor, or I'm on the way to something, or make some really flippant, really Sherlock comments.
Fuck you, my friend,
want a bath. Oh yeah, I think we haven't talked about that. I think it's important to talk about how fucking amazing Martin Freeman was on Graham Norton the other day. Yeah. Let's just mention it for a minute.
Fuck you, I want a BAFTA.
It's gonna be the never-ending thing ever.
And like, honestly, like, this episode alone, I think, demonstrates how good of actors both got.
Yes, agree.
And I swear, like, I want Martin to win another one. But poor Benedict has been nominated so many times. give
he needs
that
to
man
get
a
one.
BAFTA.
He needs to get one, but the poor man is in competition with like major contenders every time.
Whereas the supporting role
is not that. Of course, I think Martin deserved it all the way. But, you know, it's more like sometimes people have very short parts, sometimes people have longer parts as supporting role. So you have, when you're against very, like, iconic character in the main, as a main actor, it's really hard to win. It's the same problem in every competition, like the Oscar and everything. People are so damn good, but they're against each other, so the vote is divided, and that's the
end
of it.
And I think that's what happened last year, because it was like everyone's pinning Sherlock and Doctor Who.
Yeah, he's brilliant. By the way, yeah, he's in One Man, Two Governors on stage in the West End right now.
Oh yeah, so. No, definitely not like saying he's bad or anything. No, he's very good. But
he was strange. He was a strange one.
It was a strange. Like no one predicted that outcome.
No,
least of all himself.
Yes.
No.
I don't think we have any other questions that we haven't already answered because we talked about Lestrade. Yeah. We talked about the experiment and everything. So yeah.
I would like to tell the people who are listening that I've created a hashtag on Twitter called Do the Mind Palace, which is basically a strange concept, which is, can you imagine some abstract contemporary dancing when Benedict is doing his moves? So basically this is called Do the Mind Palace. So if you fancy joining us, join us. We are inventing a new dance.
We all know that the Hound of the Baskervilles is really the Doggy of Doom now, so you should all use that as a hashtag.
Yes.
As well.
Doggy of Doom.
And Do the Mind Palace. Feel free to join us.
Hello listeners, Jen here. I just wanted to take this moment to thank the wonderful people at Sherlock NYC, especially Aubrey and Jackie, for their delightful luncheon they invited me to this past weekend. I had a great time meeting fellow Sherlockians, and both ladies were extra welcoming to this babe. Currently, Sherlock NYC is taking a couple of weeks of downtime to decompress from the amazing things they put on. They worked their asses off and didn't sleep for days in order to make the weekend happen. And for those of you who couldn't make it, I encourage you to do everything you can to get to the next event this group puts together. Keep checking their website, SherlockNYC.com, to see what they will do next. Thanks again, ladies. A reminder that you can help save Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's home in Hindhead, Surrey, by supporting the Undershaw Preservation Trust. It was at Undershaw that he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Return of Sherlock Holmes, and entertained many notable people, including Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, J.M. Barrie, the creator of Peter Pan, and the young Virginia Woolf. Today, Undershaw stands sorrowfully empty, neglected, and vandalized. Waverly Borough Council have granted the owners planning permission to carve up the literary historic house into three flats, with five more homes built on its side. Modern townhouses, or maintained as the single dwelling that Conan Doyle designed and had built. The Undershaw Preservation Trust is vigorously working towards the latter, and you can help by visiting www.saveundershaw.com, as well as following them on Twitter and joining their Facebook campaign. Thank you.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?